My guest today, Grant Smith, is the director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, based in Washington. He's been my guest on Takes on the World a number of times over the years. And that's not surprising because he has done the foremost research on the Israel lobby, gaining otherwise classified information through lawsuits and Freedom of Information inquiries, and making it available to the public at IRMEP.org, I-R-M-E-P. IRMEP.org, which I'll repeat later again in the program. He has also written 8 books, among them Spy Trade, America's Defense Line, Foreign Agents, Deadly Dogma, Neocon Middle East Policy, and Divert, which deals with Israel's theft of enriched uranium for its nuclear weapons program that American politicians and the media are afraid to speak about. His latest, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, is particularly timely. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So I want to welcome once again Grant Smith to Takes on the World.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
It's always a pleasure, Grant. On the cover of your book, there's a telling quote from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from 2001, one of those rare years when he wasn't in power, in which he said, quote, "America is a thing you could move very easily." Is Big Israel, in essence, the Israel lobby? What allows that to happen?
Yeah, that's the premise. I mean, in doing the research for all of these hundreds and hundreds of organizations that help move America Israel's way, it just seemed like the most fitting quote to put that on the cover as this is what gives Netanyahu confidence that America will always be giving unconditional support.
Well, actually, as I reported before I called you, every couple of years when the Congress, the House gathers to its committees to approve a national defense budget, they throw more money, it seems a figure, $600 million into the pot for Israel, which isn't counted on their foreign aid budget. And this is not reported at all in the U.S. media. So they need a lot of collaboration to do this.
And absolutely.
And maybe comment on this media cover-up of what Big Israel does.
Yeah, sure. Although the focus of the book, you know, you can only cover areas that have data, and it's very difficult to research what's going on inside private corporations. I mean, what's excluded from the book for the most part are think tanks that aren't primarily working for Israel initiatives, churches, religious institutions, et cetera, that do not, like the media, you just can't peer into them unless they happen to be state-run media. But, really, there is a very, very tight coordination, and Israel's advocacy units like CAMRA and others work very hard to punish media organizations. I mean, they're quite vicious about it, punish them for any sort of inquiry that they don't like. I mean, there's just no debate. There's just, if they consider it to be somewhat outside of Israel's interest, they will hit you hard. And even less reported than all these ad hoc authorizations, of course, are what's going on in state houses across the nation, where there's this constant jostling for additional purchases of Israel bonds, additional U.S. joint ventures and economic centers funded by state taxpayers to promote Israel imports and joint economic development programs, or at least that's what their position to be. Hardly any of that's reported at all. It's very difficult to get that information. And then again, as you mentioned, sometimes you just have to sue for it, which makes it very easy. You know, there are only so many lawsuits you can file in a year.
Well, you've been doing a great job of doing that. In your book, you essentially look at 336 nonprofit, tax-exempt organizations, which essentially their main focus is support for Israel. Is that correct?
Right. That's a top initiative of all of these 336 organizations. And, you know, the idea of this entire book is to answer the question, well, what is the Israel lobby? Because if you don't answer that fundamental question, how many organizations, how much money, how many people work for it, what do they actually do, it's very hard to even imagine, if you don't like the outcome, as you've mentioned, the wars and the misallocated tax dollars, you know, what can you do about it if you don't know anything about how it works? So the whole objective of this is to look at the organizations, what they're doing, what their history is, the transformations they've undergone, what the major programs are, who it really represents, and that's quite surprising, who's paying for it all, and what does it actually get from taxpayers and the government. You know, and we can certainly talk about the harm it does, which is the reason for studying in this first place. But I'd just like to mention that, you know, from the data, you really see four large categories emerge. The advocacy organizations that are currently, or at least in 2012, spent about $400 million advocating for Israel directly in front of legislative bodies, the fundraising and political action that do it at the state level, almost $1 billion, subsidy organizations that on their own send $2 billion a year to Israel, and so-called education and training organizations that really drum in lessons that the Israel lobby wants American school children and other people to learn that really fit its agenda.
One interesting thing that you point out, which I've been aware of, is that all this activity, and it's considerable activity, only is being done by a relatively small percentage of American Jews whose policies, whose positions, political positions generally are opposed, or quite often, an example, the Iran nuclear deal, which you point out, whereas the Jewish establishment, the Israel lobby organizations, almost to an organization, opposed the deal with Iran, the majority of Jews in the United States supported it, even greater than the percentage of non-Jews.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the key things to come out of the research, is really looking at just how thin these organizations are in terms of the leadership and the fact that they really can't claim to represent all of the people that they claim to represent. I mean, Pew Research did a really good study about how many Jewish Americans are even involved or members of these organizations. And, Pew is a trusted research organization. It doesn't skew its data. I could say a lot about Gallup and some other organizations that appear to. But they found in their recent study that 82% don't belong to these organizations. Only 70% are somewhat or at all attached to Israel. 57% have never been there. And so when you drill down on who's really in these organizations, and it's usually people involved in multiple organizations, it's about the size of Charlotte, North Carolina, about 774,000 adults who really do a great deal of activity, and then a much, much, much smaller number of donors who just happen to give quite a bit to many of these organizations.
So in a sense, that minority is hitting far above its weight.
Absolutely. And again, you had these so-called establishment organizations, the advocacy organizations like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. All of them came out strongly against the Iran JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal that was passed last year. And yet, you know, all of this majority, 59% of the Jewish Americans they over and over claimed to represent, didn't agree with them. They were for the deal, and that exceeded the American support, you know, by 6 percentage points. So it's amazing, again, getting back to the media, that the media props up this canard that they're representative organizations, that they're broadly funded, because it's just not true.
Well, it's interesting. You also mentioned a number of these organizations, like American Jewish Committee, which goes back a century, initially were founded for very good reasons to actually serve the Jewish community, but they were not a Zionist organization. They were late coming to the game. But now all these organizations now seem to have as their main focus serving Israel, either in terms of propaganda, fundraising, or the American Jewish Committee, for example, targets the Latino community to bring them over to Israel, and to bring it, well, their leaders over to Israel. And you have, of course, you have B'nai B'rith, which was one of the older organizations. The same thing. These organizations used to serve Jewish immigrants, but now those Jewish immigrants don't need to be served.
Right.
So you, essentially you have a pro-Israel industry that doesn't pay taxes.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, B'nai B'rith in particular, it's sort of the original social welfare organization that did so much for immigrants in terms of bringing, assimilating, helping with economics and hospitals and insurance, only to later spin off organizations like the ADL. The transformation from organizations that really did serve a social welfare purpose and got tax-exempt status because they tended to reduce government burdens. You know, the idea is if someone opens a soup kitchen and raises charitable dollars for that, that those donations should be tax-deductible because they offset what the government would have done. You can see it was clearly, they were all fitting within that in the early days. But as later waves of organizations like the American Zionist Committee and others came to the fore, you see a transformation, and American Jewish Committee and others become more hardline, you know, and make the joke that, you know, before Israel, they're kind of like the guy in the beer commercials who he didn't always drink beer, but when he did, he drank, you know, such and such a Mexican beer. In this case, it was, they didn't always support Zionism, but when Israel showed up, they all became pro-Israel organizations, and they become increasingly focused, and I would say their activity is increasingly less of a social welfare bent as time goes on. And we chart this in the book through a series of time series where you can see these four great waves of organizational formation and then how they all gradually adopt this uncompromising insistence on unconditional support for Israel.
Well, one of the things that keeps people from talking about this, of course, is the accusation of being an anti-Semite, or if you're Jewish, being a self-hating Jew. And it's interesting, one of the ADL is always taking polls to find out the level of anti-Semitism in the American public and elsewhere. And one question they always ask, do you think Jews have too much power? And if you say yes, then that makes you an anti-Semite. And you're not saying the Jews, but just Jews. And we see in this presidential campaign, and we see in terms of who Congress bends for, and we see in state legislatures where people who are calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions are finding that what they're doing is going to be banned by state legislatures, where you find that people aren't even informed about how much money their pension tax money is being sent to Israel by Israel bonds. It makes it very difficult and intimidating for people to speak out.
Yeah, this is the weaponization of polling. I would consider that language to be extremely, you know, inflammatory as a polling question. It would be much better to, if they were honest and admitted that they don't represent very many American Jews, it would say, does the Israel lobby have too much power, and field that question. But that's not their agenda.
They want they want an inflammatory question.
Right. So these polls, you know, it's interesting to see where they're fielded is where they're not. But the American Jewish Committee does the same thing. The Israel Project does the same thing. They field a poll and then they take the results and hammer on the location as being insufficiently supportive. And they do this through a conflation of what they've done for a long time, which is that Israel is the Jewish state, it represents all Jews, and that these are homogeneous groups that all support the agenda, none of which is true, but they've managed to get away with it for so long, and generally the media has been supportive of it. But there are two polls that you never see fielded in Israel. One of them is the ADL's own polls. What do Israel citizens think about these polls? How would they answer these questions? That would serve as a really welcome sort of baseline for all of these questions. And then the other is the World Value Survey, which Israel essentially does not allow to be fielded in the country because they don't want any sort of analysis of the value of that country, which is often proclaimed to be a fellow democracy of exactly the same character as the U.S., they don't want any sort of real quantitative look at whether or not that's true. And, of course, it isn't true, which is the reason they'll prohibit the polling. But it's very interesting how the ADL in particular operates. I think they're going to have more trouble the next time they try to hammer away, because people are really questioning the formulation of the questions and also the selective fielding of the polls.
Well, it'd be interesting, although I've never seen one, to poll Israelis about what they think of America. And it would be very, if that poll would privately take it, I very much doubt whether it would be published in the United States.
Yeah, I doubt that too, but even more interesting is to poll Americans about what they think, just to see how much of the Israel lobby message has been absorbed. We recently did a poll in four different countries asking Americans, if I talk about Americans, I mean in the Americas, Canada, Mexico, the U.S., and then also the U.K., we asked a statistically significant sample in each country whether they thought Israel occupied Palestinians or whether Palestinians occupied Israelis. And to cut to the chase, only in the United States did a plurality, 49.2%, believe that Palestinians are occupying Israeli territory. All of the rest of the countries are essentially understand the reality of this conflict generator. And so, you know, another poll showed that most Americans at the height of the Iran nuclear scare believe that Iran already had nuclear weapons. And so you see that this disinformation really has a huge impact on the American mind as it's drumbeat through the American media and originated by these Israel lobbying organizations that are active in putting out this disinformation.
I remember the American Jewish Committee has put out a number of full-page ads that showed a map with Iran in the center and all these circular rings, how far it would take for an Iranian nuclear weapon to hit the United States, for example, to really scare people. And you keep seeing, you see these ads, and then you see the propaganda repeated, let's say, on Fox News, and you believe actually that Iran is ready to attack the United States, where Iran has not launched a war on any country. And I don't know when the last time that would have happened. As a country, Iran has never launched a war in another country. But Americans don't know that. But it's interesting. You just change for a moment. One of the things that people will say, and these are some people who actually criticize Israel but don't want to talk about the lobby, they'll say, well, you're forgetting the Christian fundamentalists. There are many more of them, and they're much more powerful than the Israel lobby, and you can't discount them. Let's tell us about the truth about the Christian fundamentalists.
Right. Well, this is a group that the lobby began courting strongly in the 1960s to really begin forming a broader coalition. And one of the myths that's really propagated by the lobby is that they're in this important part of American support for Israel. And then they'll point to Christians United for Israel, and they'll point to other groups that are supposedly evangelical in nature, but if you start peeling away at the layers and get their applications for tax-exempt status, you'll see that they were getting major Israel lobby donations to set up their fundraising and form up their public relations. So the key organizations, there are only two of them of any significance, really started with a lot of Israel lobbying capital, and they're tremendously opaque. The Christians United for Israel has managed to bamboozle the IRS into saying that it's a coalition of churches that doesn't actually need to report anything. The International Fellowship of Christians and Jews is a somewhat large organization, but in terms of the actual thing that matters here, which is, as part of the Israel lobby, how many resources do they bring to the table? As the largest, they bring about $114 million to the table, but they're insignificant in terms of the approximately $4 billion that was spent in 2012 and that's marching very quickly up to a higher level by the end of 2020 of $6 billion that's spent in order to extract these tremendous American resources sent to Israel or perpetrated for Israel, whether it's a military conflict or whatever. So they're certainly have a tendency to believe and be willing to vote based on feelings for Israel, but they're also, as has been demonstrated by the Trump phenomenon, equally willing to abandon it for other issues of importance to them. And at the heart of this, of course, is dispensationalism, a really awkward thing for the Israel lobby to understand, which is that the entire reason for support is an extremely violent worldview that this would be the battleground for future rapture that'll be coming up. So there's a very uncomfortable alliance with these groups, constant conflict over messaging and how far forward to put these groups, which, again, are insignificant in the overall, at least financial, picture.
Thanks for that, because I recall situations in which when one had brought up the Israel lobby within groups that oppose Israel's occupation, they would bring up the Christian fundamentalists and try to downplay the lobby. And so essentially, even over the years that I've been involved in this, going back to the 70s, there has been a reticence to take on the Israel lobby and to even look at these issues by people who actually, or at least say they support the Palestinian struggle for justice in their homeland. Maybe you comment
right
on that, what experience you have had.
Yeah, I think after you read this book or look at any sort of accurate analysis of the money and the reach and the amount of multi-levels that this is operating on, I tend to believe that these organizations that are claiming that the occupation is the root of the problem are misguided. It's really the lobby's occupation of the United States Congress, as you continually talk about, in the American mind, which emerges in this study, that you have to tackle if you're going to confront this problem. You have to have the IRS stop delivering tax-exempt status and letting these groups operate that have no social welfare benefit. You need to challenge them in terms of the constant disinformation that they put out, often in coordination with the Israeli government. If you issue a Foreign Agents Registration Act order, as has been done to AIPAC while it was part of the American Zionist Committee, as has been done to the Zionist Organization of America, you have to enforce it. You can't just let them browbeat you into putting it in the bottom drawer, which is what the Justice Department has done. So I would argue, after doing this research and taking a hard look, that if you're going to tackle this problem, you need to tackle the roots of the root of the conflict and not just this occupation. That's too easy.
That's a very good point you make. Occupation is not the problem. The occupation is the problem. But Israel's most important occupied territory is right here in the United States, the U.S. Congress. We're talking with, my guest is Grant Smith. We're talking about his book, his big book, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, which is just out. It's over 300 pages, and there's some charts in the book. You look at the charts of the money donated. He did fabulous research. There's no argument to be made. No defense or no argument to counter what he has said. The way they counter it is the fact that your book will not get reviewed by any main reviewer, and you will not be interviewed on any radio station other than KZYX or maybe several around the country, small ones, because they don't want this information to get out. And this is one of the problems we have in trying to break through, is letting people know what is being done in their name. And they, and would they know, I suspect a number of them would be very angry. And
yeah,
they won't know The debates going on now, even in Israel, and the criticism being made of the Israeli government by high-ranking Israelis that I spoke about this morning, because that might interfere with the image the United States has of Israel being a shared democracy. I think the only thing we share is our ability to never apologize.
Right.
And right. to occupy someone else's land with
right.
impunity.
Right, yeah, and I think to criticize this is not to absolve, you know, the United States of all of its issues. But you also hear time after time that, you know, why focus just on this? In order to focus on this, you really need to be broader, and you need to focus on every country and every relationship that's causing issues. And I disagree with that. The fact that the lobby has made it almost impossible to talk about this with the media blackouts, with the pressure, with these organizations that are so vicious in the way they go after media outlets to report on it, that makes it absolutely necessary to focus exclusively on this if Americans are to have any idea what's going on. And to have one organization or a handful of organizations focusing on this, given the size of the lobby, is not disproportionate. But I agree. I think it's telling that there is public interest, you know, whether or not Kirkus reviews it or other organizations, it doesn't really matter, because these books do circulate. People do buy them. You can also look at the data if you're interested. Just go to israellobby.org. All of the tables are there. You don't even need to read the book. You can just take a look at the immensity of organizational activity that's going on and form a pretty good idea for yourself. So, you know, I don't think the fact that general establishment media has such a poor reputation, rivaling only that of Congress, is unconnected from this issue of the selectivity of their, you know, willingness to allow people on. And I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is when people don't take action once they're armed with this kind of information. And as you know, having spoken at the National Press Club several times, we've been holding annual conferences there that have just been growing bigger and bigger each year, not focused on everything, not focused on every social movement in America, not focused on every social welfare organization in America, but focused on the Israel lobby, which is a huge problem and costing Americans dearly. And people are coming in droves.
And that's great. That is great to see. And also, thanks to social media, if a bookstore doesn't carry a book, people can still get it. Right now, tell our listeners how they can get their copy of Big Israel. And I recommend not only that, but all the other books that Grant has written are so well documented, you wonder why nobody talks about this. And the answer is the power of Big Israel, this minority of Israel supporters in this country who cow our presidents. When an American president cannot admit that Israel has nuclear weapons, when the whole world knows it, when the media, which is not under any restriction, cannot write about Israel's nuclear weapons, there's something going on here which is much bigger than simply stupidity or ignorance. There's something much bigger. How do people get your book, Big Israel?
Sure. I like sending people to Middle East Books and More, which is of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. It's an online sort of community bookstore, MiddleEastBooks.com. So you can definitely get it there. You can go to IRMEP, and we link to Amazon.com, which, of course, has it. The audiobook and the Kindle version will be out in next month. You can also, if you're a local community bookstore, you can search the ISBN number and get it ordered wholesale as well. So these books are out there. They're available. They're summarized. They're versions. I've been writing articles based on this that appear at antiwar.com. They appear in the Washington Report. They appear at the Center for Research on Globalization. So the information's out there. I just think like big oil or the military-industrial complex, that we need to make Big Israel sort of a catchphrase for, you know, whenever you see a congressperson groveling or spewing talking points when you ask them a fairly simple question about this unconditional support that needs to be stamped with the big Israel label. That's what's behind the groveling and the spewing of talking points. So, but the books are out there. Go to IRMEP.org, go to IsraelLobby.org, go to MiddleEastBooksAndMore.com.
For an amazing tour on the Israel Lobby archive on your website, documents that you have produced over the years, thanks to pushing for documents to be declassified and filing a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, you have produced an amazing amount of documentation which is available to the public if the public knows about it and chooses to use it. I mean, you've also found information that should have been front page headlines. I remember when you got the document from the FBI in which they did not redact the name of the person in Israel who was on the receiving end of an illegal smuggling operation of American nuclear triggers to Israel and was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu, and the FBI left his name in that document. And you put it out there, but we didn't hear it from anybody else. I mean, that is the extent of the power that Israel has over American society. And that is nothing less than an occupation of the American mind, the American media.
Yeah, it's really sad when you can have a story like that and work to try and syndicate it, and nobody's interested in taking it on. It's just been a very slow process, number one, to get real information about what's going on, and then to put it out, but then to see that so-called journalists don't want to touch it. And they'll say, you know, I've had a Newsweek reporter tell me I would lose my job if I came to that conference or if I did that report. I mean, they know the score, and the lobby has invested hundreds of millions in making sure that they know it. I mean, it is career suicide for them to get into this area, and that is another reason why individuals and organizations need to become fully 100% dedicated to this and this alone, because of the inability and because of this censorship, this infrastructure censorship that's been erected.
I should say, back in the 1980s, I used to do one of the things I did on the side was get voices of progressive Israelis and Palestinians who would come over to the United States and get them interviewed in the San Francisco media, television, radio, without any problem at all. It was amazing how open it was. And now I've been told by people in the media it is tightly closed. Ilan Pape, a noted Israeli historian, a new historian, what they call in Israel, he came to San Francisco, and a Palestinian friend of a Chronicle reporter who had worked in the Middle East managed to get this Chronicle reporter to have breakfast with Ilan Pape, distinguished Israeli historian, but a critic of Israel. And as soon as the reporter sat down, the first thing he said to Pape was, I have to tell you, I'm not writing a story about you, which floored Pape, who told me the story. He floored him. He couldn't believe that. But this is a situation in America. I have a letter from a former KGO, one of their leading broadcasters, Jim Eason, who, after being attacked for having an anti-Zionist Jewish historian named Alfred Lilienthal on his program, got so battered that he said, I'll never touch the subject again. And this was in the 80s. He said, but don't tell anybody I wrote this letter as a confidential letter to you. You see, that's the power that they have, and that's one of the things I talk about on Takes on the World, and you have been doing such a great job in providing information for me and other people who are engaged in this very lonely struggle. But I think things may be changing. Israel is imploding, as we see, as I reported, in terms of the appointment of this Avigdor Lieberman, that even longtime supporters of Israel, like David Makovsky of the Washington Institute, have to express their concern about what Israel is doing. And after all, Washington Institute, you point out, is a spawn of AIPAC.
Right. Well, and Camera and Memory, those media organizations, were on the rise just as you were trying to get that word out. It's not unconnected. I mean, they are a response to good reporting on these issues that arose to clamp down on it over that precise time period.
This is, again, I want to tell people about to get the book and your website. The book Grant has put out is his eighth book, and I recommend them all. And I've interviewed you about at least for half of them. Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, Grant F. Smith, and it is available in a number of different ways. He mentioned to you, and a great quote on the cover, "America is a thing you can move very easily." Benjamin Netanyahu, 2001. Grant, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes of the World, and keep up your great work.
I really appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you.
Take care. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you very much for listening.